From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. What do you do when your life falls apart? How do you get up in the morning when your son has been diagnosed with autism? You catch your daughter with drugs, your job is in danger, you lose your spouse to a sudden heart attack, or your mother needs surgery. You know, each of us face crisis and loss in our own way, but most of us can relate to those moments when the best thing anyone can say is go ahead and cry. Just remember to breathe. Well, in her book, The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart, an emotional and spiritual handbook, beloved best-selling author and six-time Oprah Winfrey guest Daphne Rose Kingma gives us readers the tools they need to face and learn from the devastating life crises they're navigating. This new book is a hands-on guide for those times when life becomes so overwhelmingly difficult. Kingma helps us come to terms with the larger truth of our lives when we're experiencing tough times. Daphne Rose Kingma has been a best-selling author of many, many books, including Coming Apart, The Men We Never Knew, and The Future of Love. She's also appeared on numerous other television shows and media outlets. A charismatic speaker, she's presented keynotes and seminars to audiences throughout the United States and Europe, and she's coming to us today from Santa Barbara, California. Daphne, welcome back to the program.
My joy to be here.
It's been a while since we've had you back. You've been on twice before talking about other books. And concerning this new one, let's be very clear about something. This book is not for sissies.
Yes, that is so true. You're letting the word out.
So now that you wrote that in your book and reminded all of us and you've spiritually bitch-slapped us, why don't you explain a little bit about that and we'll go ahead and get started.
Well, this new book, as you know, is called The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart, and as the title indicates, you know, a person isn't going to be reading this unless they're going through some difficulty or offering it to someone who is. Mm-hmm. And as, you know, as the phrase, when your life falls apart, implies, you know, a lot is required when we go through devastating circumstances, and a lot is required on a lot of different levels.
Yeah.
And so I've really wanted to offer the truth of that and not pretend that, you know, much isn't going to be demanded of the person who's in difficulty. But I'm offering a hand to hold as you wend your way up the treacherous mountain.
Well, you know, holding people's hands is something you've done so well over the years through your books. Before I had you as a guest on this radio show, many, many, many years ago, when I went through my divorce, it was your book, Coming Apart, that became my friend and helped me go through that.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I'm so happy to know that.
Yeah. The other thing that fascinates me is kind of the story, the backstory behind either a movie or behind a book. And you had a friend who contacted you whose life was falling apart, and he came out to visit you. And it was during this time that you had with him and this conversation, and I believe a request he made of you, that's how this book began to unfold.
Exactly. He was a friend from Europe who was going through extremely devastating times on a lot of different levels. Romantically, his marriage ended. Physically, he was suffering. He'd just been diagnosed with a health problem. He just had to move. He was in a job crisis, sort of, you know, the grand slam of everything. And we'd known each other for a number of years. And he said, you know, can I come here and just take sanctuary with you for a bit? And
mm-hmm.
So I was happy to offer that. And then as he was returning home, he said, you know, just kind of in passing, Daphne, what are the 10 things I need to know to get through this? And I remember having this sinking and probably also exhilarated feeling at the time, and I thought, wow, that's like asking me to write a book. I remember just where we were when I heard that phrase. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I really, as I pondered it and as I was given the 10 things, I just thought, wow, this man is speaking for so many people in the current world situation. So many people are going through extreme difficulties. And I felt mm-hmm. like really his coming here was, you know, in a way offering the gift to me of direction about what I needed to write next.
I was going to ask you, what were you witnessing where you were at even a year or two ago when everything started to really hit the fan, especially financially? When the Madoff scheme came out, I mentioned how you've been on this show several other times. The very first guest on my show, John Robbins, got word that he was affected by that as well. And it hit so many lives. I'm also thinking about all the wars that we're currently involved with. And perhaps we even have a listener who has a loved one fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq. And hopefully they haven't been affected in a tragic way. But stress is at an all-time high throughout this country.
It is. And we can't ignore it. It's kind of like a vibration in our midst. And I think what's so scary about that, or what becomes scary, is when we feel powerless about it. And I think we as Americans often feel powerless because we've often assumed that our power lies either in our financial resources, our bank accounts, or in our ability to get control. And sometimes these circumstances that are so huge and overwhelming are really inviting us to move in a different direction, to move internally and to discover our internal resources, and to look at things from a different vantage point, from the point of view of meaning and teaching and transformation, as opposed to how can I just get back to the status quo.
Exactly. Well, because life happens and the status quo changes. When I was reading your book, I couldn't help but think of the years of experience I had with hospice, helping not only the patients themselves come face to face with, you know, pronouncement of terminal illness that totally shocked them, but also with their families. And one of the things I know you touch on in the book, and one of the things I would often bring up to these wonderful people, is sometimes you just need to cry. You just need to let it out.
Yes. And as you noticed, that was the very first chapter in the book after the explanatory introduction, because we really do have problems with that. It's like kind of the last thing we think of. Even last week, I was sitting in my office with a woman who just went through a very devastating thing, and she started crying, which was totally natural, and she immediately apologized for it. You know, like, somehow I should be able to get through this experience of incredible loss without having to shed a tear. And of course, that's not true, and we really need to allow this in ourselves and allow it in others who are going through extremely difficult things, because it's not just that we're, you know, being babies, as sometimes we self-critically say. We're not being babies. We are, in fact, using the body's mechanism to restore equilibrium.
You know, you've had a 25-year practice as a psychotherapist in both Santa Barbara and Beverly Hills in California, and I'm wondering, you're hearing all of these stories, and you're receiving, you know, personal crises day in and day out, and I'm wondering, how do you deal with the balance of all of that, of taking that in, trying to be present with them, but also dealing with things in your own life?
Well, it involves a lot of self-nurturing,
and
I think that that's something that, you know, many of us shortchange. I'm very conscientious about that, I'm happy to say, and I'm very aware that there needs to be the balance. As you know, I'm a writer, obviously, I write books, but I also write when I need to express things of whatever kind, of joy, of sorrow, of mystery, of beauty. And that's a very, you know, very powerful, transformative, you know, act for me. But the other thing is, I live in a beautiful environment. I live 3 minutes from the ocean, and even on a very, you know, intense day, I can go for a long walk and just completely unwind. And, you know, often I go there to meditate, but often I just go there to walk. And so I think that taking the time to identify what nurtures you, taking the time to identify what brings you balance, and making sure, you know, we are so assaulted in this world by everything and everyone that it's easy to say, well, I don't have time for that, or I don't have time for that, I don't have time to meditate, or I don't have time for the walk, or whatever, but to make those things a priority. And I have to say that I am pretty good at doing that.
Yeah.
And it makes all the difference.
Oh, I bet it does. I remember when you came on last time, you mentioned how you didn't feel like, even with the glut of books that we've had, and even the TV shows and the CDs and the DVDs, that we still don't love ourselves very well.
Yes, that was my last book, wasn't it?
It was.
And I think that, first of all, permission to love ourselves. I was just working with somebody today, actually, who was beating herself up about not doing enough this, that, and the other, you know. And then she did something very generous for herself, and she said, well, I guess that was good. And I said, not only is that good, that's cause for celebration. I mean, we really need to celebrate when we can take the initiative of caring for ourselves. And it's not just, you know, a good thing for you, but I think in the world we need examples of people who are saying, my life and my physical structure and my state of mind and my spirit, how those all are operating, you know, is an example to other people of the beauty of caring for yourself. And caring for yourself, I think we can underline too, as I have, you know, this is a book about hard times and crisis. And in hard times and crisis in particular, you really need to take care of yourself. You really need to sort out your priorities. You really need to look after your well-being, because, you know, life is stressful as it is, but if we don't attend to these things when the world is falling apart on a personal level, then we really become victims of the crisis as opposed to, you know, victors and transformed by whatever that experience is in our lives.
Yeah, I'm taking a moment and thinking what it would be like to live 3 minutes from the ocean, whereas I live 3 minutes from a cornfield. So maybe there's...
Well, I'm just kidding. Walking through a corn... Now, that reminds me of my youth and the kind of wonderful, mysterious magic of just walking through the cornfield with the leaves waving in the summer.
They have corn in Michigan.
Yes, we had corn in our yard, as a matter of fact, and it was something I loved to do when I was a kid, was sort of wander through that kind of whispery scene.
you talked about the crisis and hard times we're in. Can you share a little bit about the story of Roy? It was a prisoner who contacted you.
Yes, what a beautiful question. He was a man, obviously, who'd had a very excruciatingly difficult life and many, many horrendous family circumstances, many series of fathers and stepfathers who left, and one who actually died while he was watching. And as a very young man, he got into a bar fight, and not intentionally exactly, but he ended up killing another man in kind of self-defense. And he's been sentenced to many, many years, really the rest of his life in prison. And this journey, obviously, crisis upon crisis upon crisis in his life, which has landed him in prison, has been actually the making of his soul, I would say. And he's become a writer, and he's transformed his spirit and started many wonderful opportunities for self-expression and expression for others. And he and I connected over a book that I wrote about men, and he talked at great length about how so often men get stuck expressing their anger when really they have grief to express. And I think that's a, you know, certainly a teaching of this book. Please express your grief. Please go to your tears so that it doesn't come out in some other form. And I also think he's one of these people that, you know, all of us need to have compassion for. There are so many people suffering in our midst through devastating circumstances, through mistakes they've made, through, you know, being caught in natural disasters. And so it isn't just ourselves that we need to grieve for. I mean, I think compassion is empathic grieving for others and realizing that, you know, the human situation is constantly taxing to us, mm-hmm. to all of us. And it's only through feeling with one another, it's only through offering our compassion that we, you know, we can somehow ameliorate that and we can somehow feel deeply connected to other people.
I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, what Journeys Fire is so much about is not only loving ourselves, but also one another and the earth. And in a time when people literally feel, I think, the energy of stress and crises in the world, it would be really easy to insulate ourselves from the suffering of others around the world. And we really can't do that. We shouldn't do that.
We can't do that. I mean, we shouldn't. And what is amazing, I think, and a weird gift of this time, mm-hmm. is that we no longer can do it. We can't be unaware. We can't not notice. We can't not hear about, you know, the president of Poland's plane going down.
Oh,
we can't not hear about, you know, the people in Haiti who are crushed under the building. And so this is a great awakening to our collective consciousness of compassion. And yes, it's a lot of energy to carry in terms of awareness of stress, but it's also an incredible opportunity to feel our humanity and our wellspring of compassion, and to put our own sufferings in perspective, too.
Absolutely. Something that might be challenging for some people to hear, and you remind this, and I think it's wise to do that to many people who find themselves in these situations, that there is a purpose in the crisis somewhere. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, there is a purpose in the crisis. And that is something that people often don't want to hear when they're in the midst of it. You mean this is, you know, this illness is meaningful. It's meaningful that I lost my house. It's purposeful that, you know, I just lost all my money. And yet, when we look at these things in the larger framework of what is really ultimately important in life and what is really ultimately important about our spirits, is that, you know, if we just have a cushy life and our souls are never developed and our capacity to love is never developed, that isn't a very worthwhile life. It's when we get in touch with the depth in ourselves, with our souls, if you will. People have different words for it, our divinity, our God, our whatever you want to call it. But the thing in us which resides and endures beyond the framework of this life in some form or other. And then we suddenly realize that, you know, circumstances are not the ultimate. Circumstances are just the vehicle of our growth. And I really do not know of one person that I've worked with who's gone through an amazingly excruciating thing, who hasn't said on the other side of it, but this cancer was the best thing that ever happened to me, but losing my house was the best thing that ever happened to me, losing my job was the best thing that ever happened to me, having this marriage come to an end was the best thing that happened to me, because there is always fruit of this anguish if we are willing to go through it consciously. And those are the amazing transformations that happen. I mean, I just heard the story the other night of the very wealthy man who had this huge house and suddenly, you know, was going to have it as his dream house for the rest of his life, and then fell on financial hard times and, you know, went to the ocean and just stood there weeping, and then finally said, what can I do for others tonight? And drove into town and served dinner to 300 starving, you know, poor street people, and said, you know, suddenly I felt the vitality of my life. You know, suddenly I felt my purposefulness. Suddenly I felt connected. Suddenly I felt my love.
Yeah.
And so we don't feel that when we're just indulging ourselves. We don't feel our beautiful humanity. We don't feel our compassion. We don't feel the exquisite depth of our spirits when we're just kind of, you know, shopping at the mall.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the purpose of all these experiences, is to wake us up to, you know, what is deep in us and what lasts and what brings us into communion with others.
You know, I've always believed that a miracle is simply a change in perception. And getting back to this story you just told about this wealthy man, That's what happened to him. He shifted his perception. Well, you write in your book, changing your consciousness and thus your experience of life, which is what he did in that moment. But it begins with an act of courage. It's not easy, but it requires courage to do that.
Yes, and it's not easy, and it doesn't always happen as it did happen for that man in the space of one afternoon.
I mean,
often we have to take many stumbling steps toward our own courage, you know, to really make the changes that transform us, because there's a very powerful instinct in all human beings to hang on to what is, you know, the status quo, however you pronounce that, is very powerful, and it's kind of a basic law of physics that, you know, whatever is now has a lot more energy holding it in place than whatever, you know, can be initiated into motion. And so we're like that as people, and we're scared of the future, and we don't know the unknown, and we are so accustomed to the illusion of being in charge that it's scary to step off, you know, the end of the plank or the rope over the rushing river to go for a swim on a summer afternoon. And so we resist this, and so sometimes this path of courage and transformation is created through many small steps. And, you know, I remember saying somewhere in the book, you know, sometimes we just bumble forward. You know, it's not like graceful or gorgeous or intentional or proud or self-assured, but it's just sort of like saying, okay, I've got to move in this direction, because in that direction, newness will come. And so the real message here is, it doesn't matter if you do it beautifully or if you get your courage all in one fell swoop, but it matters that you keep taking the steps. And, you know, I hope that I've offered really helpful guidelines and directional signals here for people to kind of reach out and say, oh, that's the way I can go. That's a path I can take.
Yeah, well said, well said. It's a nice reminder. It's like grief, same thing. Everybody grieves differently, and how we handle a crisis, it's going to be different for each person. There is no necessarily right way, and for some it's quick, and for some it's just going to take a while.
Yes, exactly.
This thing about we don't know the unknown brings up also some wisdom that you shared with your friend and that you also write about. And it's one of the things that's most powerful for me. And again, I learned it a lot in the death and dying world, and that is letting go.
Yes.
Letting go can be so beautiful, but it can also be so frightening.
It is so frightening, even just the minutest things. You know, spring comes early to California, and I guess that always inspires me to clean my closets and let go of things that I'm not needing at the moment. And it's just always so interesting to me that, you know, obviously I believe in the principle of letting go, but when it comes right down to this coat or that skirt or that pair of shoes, you know, it's like so interesting to notice the tendrils of attachment, you know, whether is it, will I never get another one like that? Will I never have another pair of shoes in my life? You know, all the different ways that we hold on. And even though I know that in the core of my being that it's good to let go, I'm just always fascinated with how hard it is, you know. And it's hard about material things, and it's hard about attitudes, and it's hard about, you know, ways of being we've had. And I've noticed that so many times working with people who are going through the end of a relationship. It's like letting go of that, you know, that family configuration or that marital definition or that style of life that we've become accustomed to. And so it is always, you know, a leap of faith or a stumbling walk of faith or, you know, an act of mini or big courage that takes us to the future. And I guess the message here is that, you know, don't be ashamed of your fear, don't be ashamed of your reluctance, because that's just part of the way it all happens for us.
Yeah, and there is some wisdom in allowing our hearts to take the lead. Can you share just briefly another wonderful story in the book that you write about concerning Matt? the MBA businessman.
Yes, that is a wonderful story, isn't it? A young man who, you know, had a heart attack at a very young age. He was 33, and he was a very successful young businessman, remarkably so for his age. And he had a heart attack and was obviously hospitalized for a time, and then, you know, he was invited back to work, and he said, no, I really need some time off. And the people who employed him really tried every way to seduce him back to work, you know, with, you know, all the promises of a great business life and the fact that he could run the company one day. And yet this guy really had the sense, I mean, I think that was his heartful intuition. He said, no, this is a huge message, and I need to see what it's saying to me. And he got in his van and drove up and down the coast of California and really kept feeling that he was being shown a new way of living and a new world, you know, basically, that he had to get into. And as a consequence of that journey, he stumbled into a yoga training center and became a yoga teacher. And, of course, the people in his business kind of thought he was nuts. You know, he'd gone off the deep end and, you know, had too long of a vacation. But he said, you know, often said later that his heart attack led him to the path with a heart. And he's a, you know, he's a wonderful yoga teacher and nutritional advisor now. And so they're amazing outcomes that show up for us when we take the invitation of crisis to show us a new pathway.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, was it the movie The Raiders of the Lost Ark? There was that invisible bridge, and as he took each step, more of the bridge would show itself as he's crossing this chasm. I always remember that scene in that movie. It was so long ago, because when we're walking a path like that, we don't know where it's taking us. It really is a path of courage and faith. But oftentimes, if we're following our heart, that it leads us to a far better place.
Yes, yes. And that's the great news of this, that, you know, it's not a journey of going back to the status quo, but it's really a journey into the future, and the future is alive with possibilities mm-hmm. that will astound you.
And we can lose a little bit of ourselves when we find ourselves in our own personal crisis. You're such a good wordsmith. One of the phrases you coined, and I'd like for you to talk about your own personal story. You said, your path is walking you even when you're not walking it.
Oh, yes.
And there was a time when you even had some questions about yourself and maybe some doubts.
Well, I've certainly had a number of those times.
That is so good to hear.
That could be a long catalog. But I think the one you're referring to is the one that I talked about, which is that recently, and that's why I haven't been on your show for a while, because I took some time out to do some other writing. I'm not just a writer of these books about relationships and personal healing, but I'm also a poet and fiction writer, and I really wanted to take some time out to just kind of indulge that talent in a freewheeling way, and I did that, and I just went through a real crisis of faith about that at a certain point, thinking, why am I doing this, and who's seeing this, and why did I think I was a writer anyway, and just so, you know, all those fears that come up when we're on a journey to the new, you know, they all came up for me just like gangbusters, and I got in a really mopey but also powerfully self-examining time, and you know, looking at all the defeating experiences I had. And I really was really willing to surrender it all and say, you know, maybe this isn't my path. Maybe writing isn't my path. And I think there's a clue there. That was the letting go moment of saying, you know, if it isn't my path, I'm willing to let it go because I trust that there is a path for me.
Yeah.
And that was very liberating. And then I came back, I was visiting my daughter, and I saw this wonderful sign over her stove in the kitchen that said, you know, whatever is probably your path is something you loved to do when you were a kid. And I remembered, of course, just falling in love with words when I was a child and telling my mother even then when I was a little girl of 7 that I wanted to be a poet when I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
She was so beautifully responsive. she immediately got me a book to write my poems in, and that has continued to be a thread through my life. And I guess that's what I meant by that phrase. It's like, I can't stop writing.
Yeah.
I mean, writing always comes to me. Words come to me and beg me to write them down.
Yeah.
And so that is true of each of us. There's something like that that each person has that that is what I call in the book, actually, your signature strength. And it finds you and it shows you how you can navigate through life and, of course, how you can navigate even through very dark hours and times of crisis.
Absolutely. Well, now the Life Purpose Coach in me is coming out. What you just shared is, I think, is key because it is really important. I think for our listeners, they might want to go back at 6 or 7, if they can remember that far back. You know, what did you enjoy doing? What did you love? Because chances are that is your signature. And along the way, as we get older, we can lose ourselves. Because you also talk in the book, and it was interesting to read that because you're such a successful author yourself. But in college, you had teachers who were brutal concerning your writing, who probably discouraged you from being an author.
Yes, they did. And I think that's, you know, a clue for how the path is. It doesn't just unwind in front of you like the yellow brick road. There are plenty of witches and challenges along the way. And I think we know that that is part of the mythic journey. We don't just get to go in a straight line to wherever we're meant to be. But there are challenges, and that's part of the development of your strength, too, is that it's challenged, but somehow, even in spite of that challenge, it continues to be there as a resource for you.
Something that I read that I didn't know, and it really struck me, given the wealth of information, books you've written, things that nobody has even read yet, the poetry, things like that. You said that your father, who was an English professor, had died before he ever read a word that you had written. What was that? What's that like for you, that he was never able to read anything that thousands of other people have read all around the world?
I know, that's poignant, isn't it?
Yeah.
I remember when I was a little girl, my mother used to read me Bible stories, and she always read the story about Moses and how he led the Israelites for those zillions of miles and years, and that he wasn't able to go into the promised land. And I remember as a kid that affected me so much, like, how can that be fair? he did all the dirty work, and then he doesn't get to go to the land of milk and honey or whatever. I think that's what it was called.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was a very instructive story to me as a child. And I realized, you know, with poignancy, I mean, it was quite a number of years after my father died that my first book came out, and my mother was dying at the time. And I just realized that their gift, each of them in a different way, had been to nurture that aliveness in me, that talent in me. My father did it by example and by teaching me words when I was a little girl sitting at the kitchen table. It was a really beautiful time we always had together. And my mother, of course, did it by giving me the book to write the poems in. And I realized that, you know, they had played their part. And the important thing wasn't that they got to see it. There was some poignancy about that. But I realized that the important thing was that they had given it to me and that it was a gift I could share. And so I think, you know, that's a letting go, too.
Absolutely.
How do we think it's supposed to be? Well, my writing's only going to have meaning if my mother and father saw it. No, that's not true. It has meaning, has great meaning that they nurtured this gift in me, and it has great meaning that I've been able to share it. And I'm sure wherever they are, they're noticing and celebrating and, you know, being glad for the part they played. And that's not the important part. The important part is that the gift was given and received and that it's given again.
Yeah. Again, the title of your book is The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart. In this book, you talk about the importance of living simply, about how to integrate your loss. For the sake of our time together, I'd like to close on love, about going where the love is, the reminder that love is really all around us. And when we find ourselves in times of crisis, it's really an opportunity for us to know that we're all connected, that we really do need each other.
Yes, absolutely. And that is the great fruit of these difficult times, because sometimes we forget that when things are going along, you know, well, in quotes, I'll put that. And it is known by, I think, every soul in the deep layers of their being that really love is the only thing that matters on this journey of life. And that's what we are here for. That's what we're called to do. That's what we're called to offer. And, of course, the beautiful thing about these challenging times is that we see our love blossoming, and we feel ourselves being loved greatly, too, in miraculous, surprising, big and little ways through these difficult hours.
The book, again, is The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart. It's an emotional and spiritual handbook. Daphne Kingma, it's always a delight to have you with us.
Such a joy to be with you.
Keep dancing.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed all of Daphne's books, and if you'd like to visit her online, go to daphnekingma.com, and that is today's program. I want to thank you once again for joining me. I want to thank my engineer, Kylan Talley, and, of course, production coordinator, Angel Richardson. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journeys Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.